Welcome. Good to see you all this evening.
I'm David Goh, the director of the Ronnie Center, and it's a pleasure for us to have our colleague, Professor Tom Faulkner, here this evening. Some of you may have heard him a year or so ago when he spoke on the United Church and war. The uncertain
sound.
Trumpet's uncertain sound. You didn't even remember that, did you?
I'm shaking my core.
Which was a remarkable, grows out of a remarkable body of research and reflection. Professor Faulkner is at the University of Winnipeg, teaches in the theology department there. He taught for many years at Dalhousie, in one of Canada's finest cities, Halifax. And he, for many years, was also the Canadian correspondent for the Christian Century. I've always admired the range of his work, and he has, for a number of years, been reflecting on war, and also, of course, religion in that context. Tom is working with Romeo Dallaire, trying to think through how in the world we can do things which will be life-giving for children, which are snatched and abused in manners that make the word sound so simple, and then pressed into various kinds of militias. So he's on the front lines of that consideration. So I'm delighted that you're here tonight and going to open it up for us a little bit. And he wants you to reflect with him on this, because it's very much a work in progress. Welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you very much, David. It's such a delight to be invited to come here to Camrose and to the Augustana campus, and I'm very grateful for the invitation. And it is a work in progress, one that will only thrive as we're able to bring people together to accomplish something in confronting this terrible problem of child soldiers. And so I'll be making a presentation tonight, and in fact at the core of it will be flying some new ideas that I've had about what might help us in dealing with child soldiers. And I really mean flying them, because I'm not certain that they're going to work. And there are people here with wisdom and insight who may be able to keep me from making a horrible mistake, or may be able to encourage this direction in research. I am here because I'm a member of the coordinating committee of the organization known as the Child Soldiers Initiative, and I want to tell you a little bit about that. There are other bodies working on the issue of child soldiers, of course. Perhaps the best known one is War Child, a wonderful organization with branches here in Alberta, and one we're working actually to develop a much closer relationship with. good, it does work. Thanks, Dietmar. Might actually start to look like I know what I'm doing up here with all the technology. So, the issue. In over 30 countries around the world, children are directly involved in all aspects of the horrors of modern warfare. We have always had, in human history and across cultures, child soldiers. But there are more of them, and the proportion is growing today. And the reason has to do with the character of war in the modern world. It has been about 30 years since there's been a standard shooting war between states in the world today, where that's the kind of war I think that we've been prepared for. It's the kind of war that produce the United Nations and other international institutions that are supposed to respond to the plague of war. But in the last 30 years, the warfare has not been between states. The warfare has been between human communities, some of whom are entering into conflict with each other in an area that might be called a collapsed state. Certainly, I think Somalia would be a good example of that today, perhaps the former Yugoslavia as well. And then there are other places where the state is actually turning against its own people. I think Myanmar would be a good example of that. And other places where there are groups that are trying to break away from a particular state and its jurisdiction. Think of the Tamil Tigers and what's been going on in Sri Lanka. And the reason this warfare, then, that is not between states but is between peoples or peoples versus a state, is called asymmetrical war. And the simple fact is that one side often has access to F-18s and can deploy them. And the other side doesn't have access to F-18s, has found that it can get all the AK-47s it wants, but that they aren't much good against F-18s, and so they look for a new weapon system, and children are the new weapon system. Children are the new weapon system. These children are denied their childhoods. They serve as soldiers, as human mind detectors, as porters and spies, messengers, perpetrators of suicide missions. In addition to these duties, girls in particular are often taken as wives, deployed as a reward to soldiers, or forced to serve as sex slaves. The UN estimates that there are between 250,000 and 300,000 child soldiers around the world today. And they are involved in over 30 conflicts that are found in different places around the world. It is, I want to stress, very difficult to judge accurately how many of these child soldiers are girls, but there are some estimates that have said it's as high as 40%. So it's not just boys, which is, I think, what you might have expected in the first place. Oops. Is there a way to go backwards here?
On that slide, go down from the previous. There's next, and then there's previous, the second one.
I know where it is. I can't get my reflexes to. Oh, you're so good.
Wow.
No, and that's not the one I wanted, actually. It's the one before that.
That's the one before that.
Let's see if I can do it. Oh, mercy. No, I've.
There you go. You can do previous there.
I could if I. There.
Do the same thing again.
Twice in a row you want me to do that? That's asking a lot. There we are. Okay, so where is this happening? Here's a chart. You'll notice along the bottom, the G identifies government armed forces that use child soldiers, the P, paramilitary forces, and O, armed opposition groups. And I think just eyeballing it, you can see that for the most part, the child soldiers are found in Africa, in those parts of Europe and Asia that are coming unstuck, and of course the Middle East and Southeast Asia. Everybody agrees officially that this is wrong, that it is not just evil but criminal, and the relevant instruments that define this are found on this page. The UN Declaration of the Rights of the Child, early as 1959. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child from 1989. An optional protocol on the involvement of children in armed conflict, which received many signatories in 2000. Though, by the way, the United States is one of the people who notably has not signed on to many of these instruments. The International Criminal Court in The Hague, which is one of the new, relatively new institutions that is now trying to enforce some of this, the Paris Principles that are very important in defining child soldiers in February of 2007, and of course the UN Security Council Resolution 1612. So we know this is illegal as well as being a bad thing. If you are interested in a very eloquent and relatively short and certainly recent account of child soldiers. I want to recommend this one by Donald Dunson. He's writing about northern Uganda, the trials of the Acholi people, the work of the Lord's Resistance Army there. Friends of mine who've spent time on the ground in northern Uganda tell me that they think that Dunson is a little easy, too easy on the government forces in this book, though I do say that he's critical of both sides. He is a Catholic priest who's been part of the Mary Noel mission in Africa for many years and has spent many years in northern Uganda himself. And what he tries to do is to put some, not just raise up statistics, but actually tell the stories of the child soldiers and see it from their point of view. This is a book that is filled with levels of violence that exceed my imagination. I know about all this stuff really because of books. I'm a scholar who reads books and thinks about them, and I don't have the direct experience, but I have spent a lot of time trying to imagine violence and what goes on in war. The real stuff goes way beyond that in this case. It's pretty horrific. Dunson is, I think, also worth reading because he tries to think about it theologically. He tries to think as a Christian, and he's speaking really to Christian communities in particular in the developed world, the West, that who need to take this issue seriously and mobilize to try to do something to eradicate a horror that's happening a long way away, but it's happening because of things for which we are, in a significant degree, responsible ourselves. It's a small world, and nobody escapes responsibility for what's going on in this thing. So, who are the participants in this organization known as the Child Soldiers Initiative? I want to introduce them to you. The principal one is our chair, Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire. You will probably know him as the UN commander during the Rwandan genocide of 1984, and his autobiographical book about that, which has been made into a very fine movie, I think, starring Roi Dupuis, is Shake Hands with the Devil, co-written with one of his adjutants, Brent Beardsley. Dallaire was sent to Rwanda to ensure peace, and he had 30 soldiers with him, and 600,000 people died. Retail, not suddenly by weapons of mass destruction, but cut to pieces in a particularly brutal fashion. There were cadres that were trained to use machetes to execute children in front of their parents before then cutting the children apart. And that's how the 600,000 died. It was grim stuff, and Dallaire came back and had a psychotic break because of it. He recovered from it, and he's devoted his considerable talent and his position as a senator in the Canadian Parliament to trying to eradicate child soldiers. He's a very interesting and fine man. There are other institutional members of the group. Search for Common Ground is a non-governmental organization based in Washington with reach at the global level. A lot of support from the European community, as well as North America, United States in particular. Dallaire Incorporated, it's not exactly a profit-making outfit, but the general does get invitations to speak, and all of his fees and whatever wealth he can generate goes right into this. There are three universities that are partnered. Dalhousie University Center for Policy Studies is generating a new center for peace praxis, and they have just recently joined this organization. The University of Victoria, and in particular their Center for Child Studies, is an institutional partner. The University of Winnipeg got involved, I think primarily because Lloyd Axworthy, when he became president of the university, had a track record and a background in international affairs one of the authors of the R2P doctrine and initiator of the Landmine Treaty, and Lloyd brought the University of Winnipeg into it. And then there's the Pearson Peacekeeping Center, which is the, I guess you'd call it, it is an NGO that serves as a training center for officer corps involved in peacekeeping, primarily UN and NATO, but they welcome anybody. And I have occasionally worked as a consultant with them. They're very skilled at training and simulations. Now, how does the Child Soldiers Initiative work? It's aiming to create a dialogue among those who are involved in confronting the problem of child soldiers. And what we're, in particular, I think, the gift of the Child Soldiers Initiative among all the groups that are working around the child soldiers issue is that the Child Soldiers Initiative, both in its construction, its shape, and its focus, understands that one of the most serious problems we have in this issue and in what's called peacekeeping generally is the inability of security forces and humanitarian organizations to work together in an appropriate fashion. This, I think, is a terrible problem, and it's pervasive, and in some ways I think it's becoming worse as we go along. People in humanitarian organizations, some like the International Committee of the Red Cross, for example, are absolutely rigidly, for the last 100 years, opposed to working in any hand-in-glove way with security forces. It's what the Red Cross does. They keep absolutely clean of any involvement like that, and if their workers are threatened with violence, they don't depend on the security forces. They either die or they pull out. And that's the way the ICRC works, and I think that's a good thing for them. Others, like Médecins Sans Frontières, World Vision, UNICEF, a whole range of NGOs who are involved in working in conflict situations, have a disposition to think, and they have some reason for this, I think, are disposed to think that security forces, whether it's the military or the police, have too ready a reflexive resort to violence and coercion to address the problems in a situation where one has to build capacity for peace. And there's real tension because of it. The security forces, on the other hand, are prone to think that the humanitarian organizations have their head in the clouds and don't see the dangers that are there for the victims who are suffering and who might be protected by a show of force or the use of force. And in fact, often the security forces feel threatened by what the humanitarian organizations do. I won't dwell on it unless you want to in conversation, but all you have to do is look at the Rwandan situation and see the downside of the declaration of a truce that the humanitarian organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières insisted on, whose actual result was that the shattered partisans who were causing the retail violence were able to regroup and reconsolidate, and there was a further genocide of another 200,000 people that followed afterwards. So it's, there are suspicions on both sides from these two groups, and it's partly to do with their culture, not just their actual decisions and what they do, but they've got to work together. And it's hard to get two different cultures to work together unless they have a working agreement about how the lead ought to pass back and forth between the two of them and how they can't exercise a veto over each other. They have to actually work together. So CSI, because of its membership and its awareness of this disjunction, really has that particular issue right before it at all times. And it's a terribly important issue in peacekeeping and trying to do development anywhere in a situation where there is conflict. CSI seeks practical solutions that will work on the ground. The tools that we're trying to develop have proposed solutions that are then tested into by simulation models, which are adapted from military training models. I'll be saying a little bit more about this, for example, of a simulation that was run a couple of years ago in Accra, in Ghana, at the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Center. And what we're looking to do is to then find a way to use the practical materials that we develop for people who are on the ground in a conflict situation, put that into a field trial with an existing recruitment case of child soldiers and see how that works. And then our aim is to broadly distribute those instruments to people who actually have to deal directly with child soldiers in a conflict situation anywhere in the world. There have been three steps so far in that process. The CSI is very new. I should say I just joined it as the University of Winnipeg's representative last summer, so I'm the new kid on the block for the most part with this. But it began in the summer of August 2006 when there was a workshop that was called together with 100 participants from humanitarian organizations, from security forces, all of which had had experience in confronting the problem of child soldiers, and also had many child soldiers, former child soldiers themselves involved in this. This, I should say, was in a way was easy enough in Winnipeg. We have actually several former child soldiers who are either full-time students or staff members at the University of Winnipeg. And I think it's also accurate to say that one of the big street gangs, the Mad Cows in Winnipeg, has a number of former child soldiers who have not exactly been rehabilitated, as far as I can tell. So this meeting came together in Winnipeg a week or so in the summer of 2006, and it led to the establishment of this organization under General Dallaire, the Child Soldiers Initiative. The group then spent the next year preparing a draft of what we called a toolkit. The idea was to produce a multi-volume guidebook, field guide, that was small enough to fit into the glove compartment of a Humvee so that a field commander could take it into a conflict situation, and so that it would be short enough that the generals and prime ministers who are orchestrating this stuff might actually read it or get somebody on their staff to read it. A preliminary version of this was tried out in Accra at the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Center with this group. These were the participants in July of 2007. That's Romeo Dallaire in the front row in the center. But as you can see, it was a group from many different backgrounds. It included former child soldiers. It included representatives of humanitarian NGOs. It included security forces. And they used a simulation model that had been developed by the Pearson Peacekeeping Center and sent out on loan. I actually had a small part in developing this model. But let me just briefly say what a simulation model is. We took the three maritime provinces and their geography and imagined a part of the world with three imaginary countries and their own imaginary cultures, languages, religious organizations, economic organizations, etc., and built up all the details of that. And then when you run the simulation, you construct a scenario. In this case, it was a matter of an insurgent group from one of the areas that was running across the border into another place using child soldiers, and there are counterinsurgency forces. What do they do with it? Everybody takes a role, plays it out, and what you find is that it's never like completely like the real thing, but it's surprising to see what happens in the group dynamics that you can learn by playing this out without actually cutting people's throats. So that was what was happening in Accra. And and then in the fall of 2007, there we are. The fall of 2007, we set up a series of small workshops, and this is where my active involvement came about, to look at this three-volume toolkit. The toolkit came in three volumes because there was one called the strategic volume that was intended for people who make the strategic decisions, the ministers of national defense, the UN secretariat, etc. Then there's the operational level where force commanders who actually deploy people are making their decisions. And then there's the tactical level for the folks who are actually on the ground in the conflict situation. And what do you do when you meet a child soldier? How do you handle it? So we took this first draft of our toolkit and we sent it out to various workshops. There were four held in Canada at various universities across the country, one at Harvard at the Kennedy Center, thank you, at the Kennedy Center, and another one in New York City. We tried for a variety of people. At the Winnipeg workshop, where we had 2 days, and I was so proud of my colleagues for being willing to break free from their classes and other responsibilities and just take two solid days out to chew this thing over. We had several people involved. Crystal Deschamps was the Manitoba officer for UNICEF, who runs educational programs in the public school system in the province. I was involved there myself. John Feller was a lieutenant colonel from the Canadian Armed Forces, the Princess Pats, who's had experience in Afghanistan and in the former Yugoslavia as a peacekeeper. Cole Kelly as a former child soldier in Sudan, who is now a student at the University of Winnipeg. David Morrow was the head of our security services at the university and who had several years' experience as an RCMP officer deployed to Afghanistan and the former Yugoslavia. Dean Peachy from Menno Simons College, the Mennonite College that's part of the University of Winnipeg. University of Winnipeg is in general a United Church school, but this we have this wonderful Mennonite College. And Dean is a social psychologist who works in conflict resolution. I think it's the biggest conflict resolution program in a Canadian university. And he has spent considerable time in northern Uganda. In fact, was just back from a year there. Paul Redekop, the dean of Menno Simons, also working in conflict resolution. And Jan Stewart, who's an educational psychologist who works with street gangs in conflict situations in Africa and in North America. So it was a very diverse group with a lot of experience that chewed over these drafts of the product we were trying to produce for the Child Soldiers Initiative, the three volumes, Strategic, Operational, Tactical. The results of these workshops that were held last fall were that there were two strengths and two weaknesses that we identified. The strengths were that the standard military design made them familiar to those who would actually have to use these things in the field, and it really could be packed into an SUV's glove compartment. So there was a chance at the commander actually making use of it. The weaknesses was the military design, that it just set everybody's teeth on edge if they weren't already part of the security forces. The humanitarian folks had real difficulty with it. And in principle, I think some of the thoughtful military people did as well. One of my bleats, and David was kind enough to listen to me whining about it all the way here from the airport, is that most of what passes for planning in the modern world here in North America started with the military. And then it gets picked up by business and used and deployed in business operations. And then universities think, we've got to find some way to justify all that public money coming to us. And so we grab onto these business plans that came out of military experience and deploy them as strategic planning in the university. And it doesn't, in my humble opinion, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And by the way, I'm one of the few Canadians who actually served in the armed forces, and that's how I put myself through college. But I was in the Air Force and in NORAD. Not old enough.
You weren't a child.
I wasn't a child, that's for sure. No, I was in NORAD. And I remember one summer taking part in a continent-wide exercise. My base was wiped out in the first 15 minutes. 40% of Canadians were estimated to have died, and we thought we'd won. But I learned how to shine my shoes and speak French, and I really admire professional soldiers, because in my experience, they have a horror of violence that far surpasses any civilian I've ever met. The second problem with the draft of the toolkit was that it really didn't acknowledge the expertise that was building up among users out there, whether they were security forces or humanitarian organizations. We sounded like we were telling them what to do and they were totally ignorant. One of the problems with the child soldier issue is that it is very complex. Nobody has ever pulled together all of the experience and research and made it accessible. But there is a lot of experience out there about dealing with child soldiers. So we figured we had something happening right, but we really had to pull it back and reconsider it. So we went through a bit of soul searching. We thought about what are our achievements to date in the Child Soldiers Initiative. This is a scary classroom. You got a clock up there that everybody in the room except me can watch it and see where we're going. So I'm depending on my ruthless friend David to cut me off if I am rambling on too long here and testing your patience, because I do really hope that we will have time for considerable discussion and comment from you here. So here we are. What are the achievements to date of the CSI? We've identified the gaps in the current approaches to the prevention of the use of children in fighting forces. And that really is due to the cultural differences between the security forces, military and police, and the humanitarian groups, Red Cross, Mennonite Central Committee, a whole range of people. So that, we feel, is a serious problem, and it's the one that we tend to address most directly. And the second point is that I think everybody knows this is a humanitarian issue. And I think it's so important to figure that out, because human beings and human organizations, if they reach any kind of consensus at all that something is a humanitarian issue, yeah, they'll be distracted by their passions and prejudices and their economic interests and all the rest of it. But sometimes people really do try to do the right thing. What happened with the landmine treaty, I think, is that even though it wasn't signed by key people like the United States and the Russians and the Chinese, even though it wasn't signed off by those folks, they aren't deploying landmines anymore because its use has been stigmatized. And so we're trying to get people to recognize that this is, yes, a humanitarian issue, but it's also a security issue. And that's important to engaging those for whom the security issues are important. The new weapon system is child soldiers. And there's a reason for that. I've already alluded to it. So there's, in addition to the humanitarian concerns, we need to find a way to address the problem of children being deployed as a weapon system in asymmetric war. How do you do that? Obviously, you don't do it simply by stigmatizing it. That's a bit like, was it Talleyrand who said the law forbids people to sleep under bridges at night, and it applies to both rich and poor? You can ban child soldiers, and the Pentagon will probably go along with it, but if the folks who think they're squaring off against the Pentagon don't have a reason to surrender child soldiers as their weapon system of choice, then they're going to keep using them. And we chose a new direction. We are in the process of consolidating our three different volumes into one so that everybody at every level can use it and see what is being proposed. And the new iteration is showing, I think, a marked openness to the expertise that may already be there in the minds and practices of the people to whom we're trying to send this field guide on how to deal with child soldiers. And we're putting new energy and new organization into a research consortium. We'll have our first planning meeting for this in another couple of weeks. We do most of this by conference calls, but sometimes we actually come together face by face. And the new consortium, which will be within the Child Soldiers Initiative, will consist of the three universities, Dalhousie, University of Victoria, the University of Winnipeg, and the Pearson Peacekeeping Center, which has a considerable research and educational dimension itself. And our purpose is partly to do new research, and indeed we're going to make a point of engaging some local university that's on the ground. One of the thoughts is Gulu University in northern Uganda. We'll do some original research, but the crying need right now is there's a lot of stuff out there. It's just that nobody has brought it together in one place and organized it and made it accessible to people who might then use it. Our goal within the CSI is just frankly a world in which the use of child soldiers is eradicated. It's not going to solve the whole problem of war. There will be lots of pain and suffering still if this is achieved, but we think it's worth focusing on this particular goal and reminding ourselves that we don't want to get halfway there or partway there. We really would like to eradicate it. How do you do that? There are three elements to eradication. You have to stop the recruitment of child soldiers. And they don't give birth to and raise up their own army. They kidnap these kids. Second, you have to be able to extract the child soldiers who've already been recruited, to extract them from the armies, paramilitary organizations, into which they have been kidnapped. And the third thing, and this really needs to be underscored, is that one has to prevent re-recruitment. There's the problem of restoring the former child soldier to their former home, often a home that, as a child soldier, they have threatened or actually attacked. And how do you deal with the natural suspicion of their own communities for these children who are coming back this time without weapons and hoping to live again at home? And how do you prevent re-recruitment? There's a terrible incident in northern Uganda where they had, in Gulu, which is the largest city in northern Uganda, there was a Catholic school that proved to be a good facility to house some 200 former child soldiers who'd been pulled out of the Lord's Resistance Army and to house them there. And you had to house them there because you couldn't leave them outside the city because they'd be kidnapped again. You often couldn't just put them back into a local area because there was the additional suspicion of them. How can we trust these kids? And so 200 of them put together in a Catholic residential school in the center of Uganda with a nominal armed guard from the Ugandan armed forces outside. And one night, the LRA descended on them, scared off the guards. Literally, they just ran, dropped their weapons, and went, which is one way of solving the problem of security forces that resort to violence, I suppose. And the kids were simply kidnapped and taken back again. Many of these child soldiers have been restored to their fighting groups more than once, and the discipline on them is harsh to say the least. So it's a major problem. How do you prevent re-recruitment? And that's what I want to... oh dear. End of slideshow. Really? Okay. I'll tell you, I had two more slides in there for this additional material, and it's just possible. It's just, and I'll tell you what, do you want me to show you what the slides look like? These were the two. The psychological, actually three. Thanks. And I could have sworn I saved that. But it's a good thing I didn't swear. Just a moment. Let me introduce it. While Dittmar is trying to rescue me from terminal embarrassment here. They would have been the last three slides before this this one. Yeah, it's not there. It's not there. Okay.
I'll get out of here. We'll listen carefully.
Okay, thank you. All right, so, how do we, what are the psychological issues involved in rehabilitating child soldiers? And I want to start by saying that there are three points I want to lift up about the techniques that are used for creating child soldiers. In the first place, the armed group that takes in the kidnapped child creates or aims to create a total environment in which every waking and sleeping moment of the child's life is conditioned and shaped and disciplined by the aims and activities of the armed group into which they are brought. And they're really given a whole new life. And there's an effort to see that they are feeling trusted and honored by the military group in which they find themselves, a sense that they owe their very lives, their existence to that group. They'll often be told that they must, that they are loved by the commanders, and that they must return that love. And in addition to that, their former home is portrayed as the enemy, not to be trusted, and is to be feared. And you can't run away from us and join the government forces when we get into combat, because they'll torture and kill you. They are the enemy, and they are bestial about it. The second point is the alienation from their former home and their family. And the way, apart from being told that this is the enemy, it is a common practice, and here I'm relying largely on the details in northern Uganda, but you'll find it in other child soldier theaters of operation. Part of the initiation and training involves being forced to kill other family members, parents being executed by knives by their children, older brothers being executed. Kids who are too old aren't malleable enough. The ones we think of as young teenagers are the favored ones. So a 10-year-old will be told, if you don't kill your 16-year-old brother, who deserves it because he's our enemy, then you yourself will be killed, and so will the brother anyway. And it's pretty grim. It's pretty grim stuff. But by forcing the kids to actually participate in the acts of violence, they feel that they're making the kids complicit to it and shifting their loyalties and reshaping their character so that they will be good soldiers. They will act under military discipline, in which the ultimate sanction for any act of disobedience, however small, is finally death. The third point I want to make is that there's harsh discipline for these kids, for if they refuse in any way to perform as soldiers or as servants or slaves to the soldiers. And this includes not simply reprimands and being sent to bed without your supper, but torture, mutilation, and ultimately death. Well, military practice. You've heard of the phrase decimation? When a military unit in the Roman Empire refused to follow orders, they put them together in groups of 10, drew lots, and 9 soldiers had to kill the 10th soldier. And that's the way you enforce discipline on the group. In the military force works because, I've used the word men, women are becoming pulled into it more and more, but men act together in concert. Any trained, well-disciplined military force, because they operate together as a team, will defeat ferocious, stronger groups of thugs who are not organized. And building a military force with 12-year-olds who are much more malleable in terms of their moral character, are given to those adolescent dreams of being half in love with easeful death, and the glory is the gloria dulce et decorum est pro patria moria. To die for my country is sweet and wonderful. It's an age group that's particularly open to this kind of discipline, and that's why it's becoming very attractive as the new weapon system. So you have these three features: the total environment, the alienation from family and former life that's reinforced by acts of violence you're forced to participate in, and harsh discipline to keep you loyal to the code and following the orders of the group. And it sounds so powerful. It's horrifying, and it sounds powerful. Now, here's the puzzling point. Hey, great, that's the next best thing. Wonderful, okay. So here's the puzzling thing. Many child soldiers who find themselves in circumstances where they're momentarily out from under the immediate surveillance of their commanders or other superiors, they often seize the opportunity to desert. They often just throw their weapons down and try to go over to the counterinsurgency forces that are expecting them to be coming at them with AK-47s blazing. It may occur, it's most likely to occur during the confusion of combat. And here I simply refer to that very helpful phrase, the fog of war. You only have to read von Clausewitz and Sun Tzu to know that the state of war is one in which everything comes unstuck in a major way, perhaps more unstuck and faster unstuck than any other human realm of activity, realm of human activity. So in those moments, that's when they seem to be ready to break free. Child soldiers sometimes surrender directly to members of the opposing armed forces whom they've been told to fear and from whom they have been told to expect no mercy, only summary reprisal. The horrific character of the psychological techniques used against kidnapped children under these circumstances in which armed conflict is either imminent or actually taking place may obscure for us the curious fact that the children often demonstrate a willingness to shake off their apparent conditioning and to seek refuge from their kidnappers with counterinsurgency forces in the field. If the conditioning is so harsh, why doesn't it prove effective at these critical and surprising moments? I suggest that there are clues to the nature and depth of the conditioning that child soldiers undergo, that they may be found in the experience of the persons living under totalitarian regimes and in the scientific literature on deprogramming in the anti-cult movement. Now, my familiarity with the experiences of persons living under totalitarian regimes is essentially anecdotal, based upon personal encounters over the years with friends from Eastern Europe, and on a 3-month stay in Lithuania last year when I spoke extensively with persons who had lived through all or part of the Soviet domination of that country. In short, these folk all report that they responded to the efforts of the state to create a total domination of their lives and outlook by creating a sort of bilingualism, some of them called it, a practice of speaking and acting in an habitual way under all circumstances that was designed to satisfy the standards of the totalitarian regime under which they lived, while cautiously revealing an inward self to the few others who could be trusted under carefully sheltered circumstances. And I think here of the sociological model I'm very fond of human personality offered by Thomas Luckman in The Invisible Religion from 1967, I think. Of course, Luckman was talking about people in the modern world generally. What I'm talking about here, people living under, say, a Stalinist regime, is an extreme case in which they have this true self that lives in private, but otherwise they're playing a role. And in the case of the totalitarian regime, the role that is played is one that extends even into family life, where your kid might inform on you because they're a member of the Komsomol and they're keeping an eye on mom and dad. Well, with respect to the scientific literature on deprogrammers serving the anti-cult movement, the crest of the controversy seems to have occurred during the 1970s in North America. Today, no respected academic authority will use the term cult as a tool of analysis, because there is a consensus that this word implies a group that is dangerous. Scholars today ask, is this new religious movement dangerous? Asking, is this cult dangerous, is like asking, is this axe murderer dangerous? You've begged the question. You've built it into the question. And it's really not a way to come at scholarship and to make it work. During the 1960s and 1970s, new religious movements, that's the phrase that scholars will use where I think popular speech would say cult, new religious movements such as the Unification Church of Sun Myung-moon and Scientology achieved notoriety by attracting persons who severed their ties to more conventional religious institutions and to their friends and families. In the case of these two particular movements, the largest, the target group appeared to be adolescents in the case of the Moonies and middle-aged men going through a midlife crisis in the case of Scientology. The transformation of the converts' behavior was often dramatic, entailing personality changes and overt suspicion, even hostility, to any suggestion that they should return to their accustomed former lives and relationships. Now, in response to a cadre of deprogrammers, in response to this, a cadre of deprogrammers appeared who offered their services, usually at a fee, to families and friends of converts wishing to remove their loved ones from the cult, as they and the deprogrammers called it, and rehabilitate them for return to their former homes. At first, there was some effort to legitimize the work and the status of the deprogrammers. And note that that name itself implies that programming has already occurred. And I'm thinking here, it's obviously a metaphor, but if you program a machine, the GIGO principle operates. Garbage in, garbage out. You program it the right way, it's nailed down that way. If you programmed a human being, they've been brainwashed and their disposition has been effectively changed. Well, the deprogrammers and their supporters went to the American Psychological Association, tried to get cult behavior written up in what was then DSM-3, and there was a ferocious controversy, got taken into the courts, actually, by one or two members of the executive of the APA who thought that it ought to be recognized as a mental illness, and finally was thrown out, both in the courts and in the professional association. And I think that it is accurate. Well, so the effort to achieve professional recognition was decisively rejected. And I think it may generally be said that no deprogrammers of the period were ever certified by any of the relevant professional bodies. For what that is worth. You know, and I think it's worth something. I do. In fact, deprogrammers were finally driven out of business by the decision of legal authorities to deal with the activities of the deprogrammers under the laws against kidnapping. This was certainly the outcome in the province of Ontario, where a royal commission supported such a practice following the complaint of a family that their child had been kidnapped and programmed by a body that generally enjoys more respectability than the Moonies or Scientology, that is to say, the Order of St. Benedict, largest of the Catholic monastic communities founded in the 7th century of our common era. However, the way in which the so-called cult won converts was presented in such an engaging and pervasive manner through the mass media by deprogrammers, desperate and outraged family members, and former cult members who had been successfully deprogrammed, it left the public with the impression that the cults were practicing a form of brainwashing and the deprogrammers were performing a public service. This widely shared public conception was challenged by social scientists in North America and the United Kingdom who studied the phenomenon over time. The conclusion of the social scientists was that, and I might say for what this is worth, that I've met the key people and heard them present their work at some of the most respected and rigorous academic forums that you'll find in the English-speaking world. The conclusion of the social scientists was that most converts to new religious movements quietly walked away from their new affiliation within 2 years of first joining. And the largest single group quietly walked away from it and returned to their former lives about a year after joining. When they returned to their former lives, they resisted efforts to get them to talk about their experience during their absence and what occurred during it, because they were so embarrassed to have given themselves heart and soul to a movement that finally disappointed them and they walked away from it. And so the people who make the movie of the week and do the reporting for the newspapers never talked to these folks. They talked to other ones. The former converts who actively sought out opportunities to describe their brainwashing by the cult were those who had undergone deprogramming right from the start. That is to say, they were kidnapped out of the cult by the deprogrammers, hired by their families. And they were put through a rigorous program of deprogramming during their captivity and then restored to their former friends and families. And these are the folks who stepped up and said, I want to witness to what happened to me when I was brainwashed by the cult. I remember being on a panel with a deprogrammer at the Halifax Public Library back in the 70s and bringing forward some of this, and the deprogrammer just flipped out. He stood up and started screaming, programming is good! Programming is good! Which, of course, to an old-line Freudian like myself, said that he knew what he was doing was programming. He wasn't deprogramming. He was programming. Well, in any case, the about 70% of the deprogramming efforts fail, because the subject who is kidnapped manages to break out of the kidnapping, and it is these people who then go back to the cult or new religious movement and never leave it. Because the experience of the failed deprogramming is that my mom and dad really hate me as much as they told me they do, and I'm going to go live with the people who love me. Well, the former members of new religious movements who walked away from the group of their own volition reported to the researchers that they had adopted a kind of shell personality that responded to the expectations of the new religious movement that had recruited them and that endeavored to create a total environment within which the new member would feel the strongest possible desire to belong to the group. And I must say this reminds me very much of what I was hearing anecdotally from people who had lived in a totalitarian society. However, these same former members consciously retained their own private personality and kept it carefully hidden from the leadership of the group, considering that this private personality was their true self. After some period of time, they judged that there was such a gap between what they hoped to find in their new religious movement and what they actually experienced in it, that the gap was so great that they took the earliest opportunity available to them just to walk away and return to their former lives as quietly as possible without explaining to everybody what an idiot they'd been for the past year or two. My suggestion is that techniques employed by those who kidnap children and train them as child soldiers may have a good deal in common with the practice of totalitarian regimes and new religious movements. I recognize the extreme violence of the child soldiers groups, but I think they're on the same continuum. You have to remember they don't just use the overtly violent techniques. It's coupled with all of the other love our leader stuff that goes on in totalitarian societies and in some new religious movements. So the groups that are trying to reconstruct the children whom they capture or recruit according to a radically new and perfectly submissive template of human personality are doing it with some of the same tools that these other groups have used, and the human subjects are responding with some of the same responses. If this is so, then it seems to me there are three lessons at least that we may derive from what we know of totalitarian regimes and new religious movements. First, however horrific or pervasive the techniques employed against their unwilling targets, the result may be the creation of a shell personality that is sufficient to protect the victim against the most deliberate and dangerous efforts of their masters to compel obedience, but that still preserves a judging, resistant inner self that the captive considers to be their authentic self. I'm not saying this happens with everybody, but it seems to happen with a lot of the kids. Second, that inner self may seize an early opportunity to relinquish the apparent behavior of the shell personality when circumstances loosen the most immediate and direct controls that have been placed upon them by their captors. And third, whatever psychological techniques are used to rehabilitate child soldiers who have been released from their captivity, those techniques should be premised upon an understanding that the inner self of the child soldier needs to be respected and taught to trust their new surroundings and society. Rehabilitation that is violent and coercive is a bad strategy, and not to be justified on the grounds that the child soldier has already been subjected to violently coercive techniques of control that can only be undone by similar techniques employed by those who wish to restore the former child soldier to their original lives and home. And, I want to just underscore this by saying that ought to remind you of one of the most common patterns in Hollywood movies. Violence perpetrated by good guys is titillating and pulls audiences in. But how do you justify it? You invariably have the bad guys doing horrible violence that then justifies the good guys doing the same sort of thing. Because they're not starting it, they're simply meeting fire with fire. And you see this in the behavior of security forces, counterinsurgency forces, dealing with elements that they're opposed to. I'm thinking particularly, we could explore it if you want in conversation, of the Waco massacre back in 1993, where the government forces surrounding the Branch Davidian compound undercut negotiations, lied to the Attorney General of the United States about what was happening to the kids on the inside, because the government forces were horrified and offended by the religious claims of David Koresh to be God. And it offended their Catholic and Mormon and various sensibilities that they held privately and as a group on the government side. If just because the ones who are committing the evil are using that kind of violence and coercion does not in and of itself justify the use of violence and coercion encountering them, and you really need to guard against it. So, well, I do apologize for the lack of slide support for that. Thank you, Dittmar, for cleverly pulling my own words out. There is a select bibliography at the end of that if people want to have a look at it. I even brought those books along with me, actually, two of them anyway, tonight. And that concludes my presentation as a report of what the CSI is doing, what it's hoping to do, and at the moment my own interest in asking whether the experience of totalitarian regimes and new religious movements might give us some clues for the rehabilitation of child soldiers. Thank you for your attention. And I certainly would welcome any comments or questions. I know that there are people here tonight who've had direct experience in dealing with child soldiers, and I'm a great believer in the wealth and virtues of experience and learning from it, and the hope that you don't actually have to live through it to share, to learn from somebody else's experience.
In the last couple of months, Edmonton has, the mayor and the chief of police have worked at establishing communication with the Somali community in Edmonton, because there had been a fair number of deaths within the community, violent deaths. They were giving the police no support at all in the police's efforts to try to discover any truth about the matter. Mm-hmm. I wonder, do you think that any of this child soldier mentality has come with that violence is the way to achieve, that they have, do you think that there is any dimension of this child soldier mentality going on in a situation like that in Edmonton?
I doubt very much that there's a leadership in Edmonton that is deliberately, as an organization, creating and deploying child soldiers. I would be very surprised to find that. But I do think that it's probable that there are former child soldiers who have found it relatively easy to adjust to Canadian society by running with a group that can use what they learned as child soldiers rather than trying to abandon that and shift into another part of Canadian society. I say I wouldn't be surprised, because my colleague and Jan Stewart, who works with street gangs, has identified that sort of young person in the Mad Cows who are so active in Winnipeg. So it wouldn't surprise me. And I guess part of what I'm saying here is that to the extent that we in our wealthy society have helped to create a world in which there's not just poverty in different places, but the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and the poor don't like that. And what can they do? Submit to the rich and hope they'll graduate into that group? I don't think so. You do what you must. I mean, without romanticizing them, street gangs perform a function. One of the things that's a truism in the study of this sort of work is that the way in which local community groups think of street gangs, The way in which security forces like the police think of them are radically different. I lived on the south side of Chicago for 7 years when I was doing my graduate work, and the Blackstone Rangers were a pretty scary group, and they committed a lot of violence, but they also did a lot of good in the community. I'm actively involved in trying to think through terrorism and counterterrorism, and it's a truism that groups like Hamas, for example, while committing acts of horrific violence, also do a whole lot of social work that the Red Cross hasn't been able to pull off on the Gaza Strip, and good work. So kids, they get something out of being a child soldier. Not enough, because there are significant numbers of them that just walk away from it. But if we think that there's nothing to be said for the people who are creating and deploying child soldiers, and that there's no justice that needs to be remedied there, we're fools, I think. There's no solution, there's no peace for the world, unless it is peace with justice.
Can I just add a little piece on to that, your response? There are, in Edmonton, a number of families that have come from various places in Africa, very difficult circumstances. In my conversations with primary mothers of those families, one of their most heart-wrenching struggles has been to see their sons going to school and growing up and coming under the influence, not of their culture, but of American gangster rap, an American black gangster culture imagery, which is completely different than anything, of course, remotely related to their own culture and even their horrific circumstances. And they do not know what in the world has happened as a result. So part of it, I think, has to do with a failure in Canadian society to properly support and bring immigrants and refugees into this culture. If they get fished out of a refugee camp, they're convinced they're going to heaven. 3 weeks after being here, they know they've gone to hell. It's an awful situation, the way in which we deal with this. Awful, anyways. But the influence on the young boys of a very common part of the popular culture of North America is what at least a number of these mothers wept about.
And let me give a concrete example from Winnipeg of what can be done. One of our United Church congregations in the North End, not far from the university campus, has a formal relationship with the local Muslim community that is Somalian. A couple of restaurants that serve Somali food, and the usual educational and social organizations that you'd expect to grow up around an immigrant religious community. The first Sunday school picnic I'd ever gone to that was a joint Muslim-Christian Sunday school picnic was held out in the Needle Park, Central Park, just outside the church, with both communities coming along and supporting each other. There's not enough of that, but I think what I admire in the process there is that the Somali community in Winnipeg is organizing itself, not simply being turned into, well, it was Ralph Connor's old vision of take all those men in sheepskin coats and teach them to think like real Brits. It preserves their communal self-respect and cultural heritage, and at the same time they're making connection with a part of established Winnipeg that is friendly and that honors their contribution to the diversity of the place. So it can be done, but I think the secret is at least in part to find established community groups that are willing to open themselves up to working with immigrant groups and not requiring the immigrants to put on whiteface and start acting exactly the way Presbyterians have been acting in Winnipeg for 100 years. There aren't enough groups doing that yet. Good, Mark.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, have you been puzzling about the practical implementation? For example, stock recruitment sounds very nice. Then you think of a failed state, or you think of Sudan, or in all the internal conflicts, who would stop the recruiting?
Yeah.
Like, who has the power, or who has the motivation? Because, as you're saying, if it's asymmetrical in power, there's a very, very strong motivation to keep on recruiting as your only way of... I mean, it's no different than the suicide bombers all over the place, the so-called terrorists. You just don't have the American military power or the power of the Italian states. So what can you use? They've got tanks. We've got people who are willing to walk the bombs over to the site, you know, where we're going to explode them. The one we bless as being, you know, state-run and good, and supposedly, I guess, and the other is evil against them, children doing it, there's terrorism. But anyhow, so that's the asymmetry which creates major problems. But in an actual situation, you know, what have you envisioned in terms of going in? I mean, that's been Romeo Dallaire's frustration, right?
Yeah.
So you set a peacekeeping group, but they don't have any power to do anything significant to change things.
Yeah. And I have heard him say, if I'd only had the 5,000 troops I'd had under my command when I was in my last posting in Canada, mm-hmm. I could have prevented it. I'm not sure he really believes that, because mm-hmm. You need a special kind of warrior.
Mm-hmm.
For starters, in Africa, I think they better have the right color skin in order to win the trust of the local communities where they're trying to reduce the violence enough so that peace can be built, capacity can be built. And frankly, there's considerable unevenness among the armed forces in Africa. The best of the lot, I think, it would be fair to say, from what I've heard, this is all hearsay for me, is the Ghanaians. And it's no accident that the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Center is the first of such an establishment in Africa. And if the other armed forces could be brought up to that level, it would be wonderful. But the Ugandan security forces, as you will see from some of the testimony in Dunson's book, child soldier, young girl, acting as a sex slave for the past 4 years, runs to the Ugandan security forces in the middle of a firefight, and they restore her to the Catholic convent 3 days later after they've raped her themselves. And unless you have the right attitude on the part of the leadership of the security forces saying this is a vile thing to do and you will not do it, it's very hard in the heat of conflict, people on the ground, to get them to behave right, because as you've heard me rant in the past, there's something about combat that dehumanizes the most virtuous and well-integrated person. And you really need a well-trained, highly committed, right from the top down, security force that will handle this properly. And that will have the kind of discipline that means when you come up against a force armed with AK-47s, filled with too much adolescent testosterone ready to shoot at you, that you actually wait before firing back to see whether they're trying to surrender or not. And then will you risk your own life and that of your comrades to get that person to a safe place and then protect them instead of running away the way the Ugandan troops did when the LRA re-recruited 200 people from that Catholic girls' school? So it requires a tremendous investment of time and energy and a willingness of human beings to risk their own security in order to help the rest. Because if you live in a world where you can take 12-year-olds and turn them into soldiers, it's a lot more dangerous than a world where nobody takes up arms until they turn 17, which is what the law says is supposed to happen.
Yeah.
So in my experience, the 18-year-olds are more, you can talk to them in a way you can't talk to a 12-year-old when they're 18.
Yeah. It removes that psychological attraction of some of these insurgent forces who want to play the child soldiers, because as an opposing force or as a UN force going into a situation or a country, they're more apt to stop and not want to create conflict with a 10-year-old kid who's got an AK-47 aimed at them. And there is also the psychological component of that force who actually does want to take down that kid because that kid's going to kill them.
Yeah.
That soldier is going to have these PTSD issues, etc., followed through the ranks. So a lot of these insurgent forces are going to continue to employ kids to use them in that manner.
And my colleague Dean Peachy, who's the educational psychologist who spent years in northern Uganda and is a card-carrying Mennonite, holds, both as a matter of principle and on practical grounds, that there's room for negotiation even with a megalomaniac like David Crony in charge of the Lord's Resistance Army. And I'm also persuaded, I know the last time I was here we had a fascinating discussion about the responsibility to protect. And it seems to me that that doctrine that's emerging in UN circles is remarkably well nuanced in this regard, that it recognizes the possibility that coercive force may be required, but that it doesn't necessarily have to happen, and certainly not as swiftly as it often has. And what I find in the books that are being written as military science, I know some people think that's an oxymoron, but military science is taking up this theme as well, saying that the kind of war we've had for the last 30 years can only be won if you win the hearts and minds of the people. And you do that by negotiating, getting everybody to see that it's in their interest to live in a world in which they seek justice, however they may perceive that, and deny themselves revenge, however they may see that, and that it's worth doing, and you shouldn't just succumb to the kind of despair that says, well, we're all going to die anyway, I think I'd like to go down in a burst of glory and maybe have a bunch of kids do it for me. And in fact, that's part of what goes on with the child soldiers practice, that we're really talking about child soldiers and the people who have chosen to make them child soldiers. There aren't 12-year-olds out there who want to become a child soldier and make themselves that. It's us, it's adults who make them into child soldiers, and we got to find a way to live with those folks and change their position. Because I don't think the way is to simply find out who they are and kill them off. We might as well be dead by the time we get halfway through that project. Yeah, it did work. Oh, I'm sorry, yes, sir.
I spent many years in Africa as a professor and a teacher. And one of the problems that I experienced when I was there is tribalism. And you haven't said one word about tribalism today.
Well, I did say it was the Acheoli, but go on. Go on with your point.
The biggest problem that when I was in Kenya, we had 39 different tribes. And nobody likes each other. When I was in the Middle East, all these Arabs that are over there, none of them like each other. And so, you know, these problems that you're having between these forces and all of that, it depends on who is doing it. And what control and where, what part of the society that they're from. Because like when I was in the UAE, they were recruiting the children, and I would, in one school that I was a teacher there, they would be, these little children would be dressed in uniforms, and they were standing at their bus stop, and they're 7, 8 years of age.
Mm.
And they're going to the military schools. And now you talk about these insurgents and these terrorists and all that. Hey, they're doing it, and they're only starting at grade 6, or 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And it's just unbelievable. But a lot of problems they have with who are the leaders. You know, like what group are they?
And you know, I think you're identifying an important issue, the issue of the tribal loyalties. But let me speak to that, and I'd welcome your comment in response. I think it's important to understand, or at least to take the position, that a tribe is not a genetic creation. I know that it is talk to any anthropologist, a tribe is a human community that thinks we're the people and everybody else isn't human. That's practically the working definition among social scientists. But the danger in invoking that as a concern is a kind of sense that, well, those people are tribal and they're stuck with that and they just can't seem to grow out of it. By contrast, though, think about what happened in the former Yugoslavia. This was a part of the world where there were many different ethnicities and over the years had been under one empire or another. And I know something of the history of that part of the world. They, for the most part, for hundreds of years, lived in relative peace with each other. I won't say that the Serbs didn't prefer themselves to the Croats, but there was peace between them. It's when Yugoslavia, an artificial creation held together by somebody with better taste than Stalin, as dictators go, but still a dictator, when it started to come unstuck after the death of Tito, I think one of the turning points was when Milosevic, who used to be one of Tito's apparatchiks, found himself dealing with a hostile crowd in the Serbian capital, and everything was spinning out of control, and he felt himself losing his leadership, and he invoked the race card, and he called up Serbs and said, "They've been persecuting us. Let's pull behind me, and I'll vindicate the Serbs." Well, and you see what happens when it turns out there are some Serbs who think they're Kosovoans instead of Serbs, and the whole thing. I think tribalism in that case is we make it up. I'm persuaded by the arguments that there's no difference between a Tutsi and a Hutu, except what are cultural characteristics that emerged under colonial rule that found it convenient to divide and conquer. So tribal loyalties, they're very important and they can be deadly, they can spin out of control. But they are not genetic, they are not natural, we make them up ourselves, and we can deploy them for good or we can deploy them for evil. In Canada, at our best, I think, we have said, you don't have to become homogenized. I mean, I think of one of my heroes, J.S. Woodsworth, a great leader of the social gospel, and Ralph Connor, who wrote The Foreigner. These are people from the West whose notion of a great future for the West meant taking all those different groups and teaching them to act like proper Englishmen, Englishmen. And so it's a choice we make. The trouble is that, like so many social choices, it's convenient for human beings to make the choice and then forget that they made it and say it's natural. Now, mind you, that can also become a strength because every once in a while I get through some really tough spots where I think, well, being Canadian means being committed to diversity, and that's why I'm so much happier than my American friends. But it's a choice. We make those choices. And so I agree that tribal is a major concern, that there's nothing genetic, nothing inevitable, and nothing essentially wrong about it, I think. It can be one of those human choices that can be a great blessing.
Now, when they were talking about the recruiting of those children, is there any tribal mix there that is stronger than others? Or just...
Well, the Ugandan security forces aren't Acheoli, and the people who live in northern Uganda tend to be Acheoli. Mm-hmm. And the Lord's Resistance Army is Acheoli. The Acheoli people are suffering under this, and they're terribly divided about it. But yeah, there are tribal elements to that, and part of what makes for bad actors in the Ugandan security forces is that they come from a different tribe. Yep, that has happened. But there are also some remarkable practices, religious rituals and deeply rooted cultural practices among the Acheoli people of dealing with suffering, of human violence one against the other, and of reconciliation that are profoundly tribal in their roots, but that I think hold promise for someday finding it possible for the LRA and the people who live in the towns and cities of northern Uganda to live without cutting each other's throat.
If I may say, just to give some flesh to the comment I made about the resources in Acheoli culture and spiritual traditions, they have a practice that is goes back into the mists of time, as they say, traditional, of raising up the ghosts of those who have suffered violence at the hands of others and placating those ghosts and making peace, helping them to rest again, so that those who perpetrated the acts of violence can themselves be free of the destructive and debilitating memory of the acts of violence that they committed. And this is part of what the Catholic organizations in northern Uganda are drawing upon in their sustained efforts to rehabilitate the child soldiers that come into Catholic institutions in Lulu today.
Yes.
Within the toolkit, and of course it's evolving, when you talk about how you stop recruitment and the extraction, that it'll be in the security officer's SUV, so.
And in the SUVs of the humanitarian organizations.
Right, yes.
The extent that they
get. I guess it would be that case.
Yeah.
And then
you may not come from a military background.
No.
See, when soldiers go into combat, mm-hmm. they expect to face the fog of war. They expect to face what von Clausewitz called friction. They expect to face what von Moltke said about no battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy. That's why they call them the enemy. It's a situation in which things come unstuck in a major way. And so, as a general rule, if the strength of a military force is, they call it a German Verteidigungsstärke, and the application of first force on a particular weak point, bringing it all together, you don't have to number them in general, you just have to apply a force in a particular place and break it up. It's that unit cohesion, working as a team. And generally speaking, unless you have a manual that you can take into battle with you where you can read it real quick, as you go, when you face a new situation, say, oh, I see this and that is happening, plan B. And, you go up and execute plan B. That's how they operate.
Yeah.
It doesn't work all the time, but it works a lot better than either just shooting the first thing you see come up, or saying, can you just hold on a moment while I think this through?
So is there any prospect of having a component then of how exactly the extraction, the rehabilitation?
Yes, absolutely.
And the community and family. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that the Pearson Peacekeeping Center, I think, has actually pioneered in military science is what is called a layered response. And it starts with the premise that you cannot make a good soldier out of a Red Cross worker, and you can't make a good Red Cross worker out of a soldier. That they have to have some understanding of what each is good at doing and why it's important that they get a chance to do it, and that they respect the autonomy and authority of that other practitioner. And so what the field guide, a good field guide, tries to do is to say, well, if this sort of thing arises, then your best shot is to, thanks for the metaphor, best shot, your best effort would be to call on the security force to act, and then once this has been established, once something has, you've reached this level of security where people are still in danger, but it's not guaranteed that every time they step outside they're going to get blown away, then you step aside and the Red Cross worker comes in, the teacher comes in to teach in the school that the engineer is rebuilding, and you try to have a layered response that's appropriate. And at the moment, as far as I can see in the literature, it's the military that are, at least in their literature, more open to that right now than the humanitarian organizations are. But that's probably because the humanitarian organizations have had so much experience of getting shot up by so-called peacekeepers who act more like General Patton.
Do you see that the ability of the NGOs and the military to find ways to work together, to develop a new kind of culture, in fact, that crosses over these two because of the amazing character of these asymmetric wars. Do you see that beginning to take place?
I do. I see it happening within the CSI, because I hear the people from the humanitarian organizations who are part of this group saying, first quietly in the corners and then actually out in public, these guys aren't so bad after all. I can think I can work with them. And vice versa. So that to the extent that, that our whole project requires that kind of cooperation and respect for our respective strengths, it models and helps to create that. Of course, I'm a religious person. At the end of the day, despite all of my liberal commitment to the academic world, and my wish to, you know what the definition of a liberal is? It's somebody who thinks things can be arranged. I think at the end of the day, we ought to try to do things because they're the right thing to do, and let's leave it in God's hand to see if it works, rather than take that to our arrogate death for ourselves. So I think it's starting to work, but that's not the whole reason why I do it, that's for sure.
But it is so interesting that this new kind of war requires a whole new kind of culture on these two agencies. So.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Don. Thank you all.
Thank you for all your helpful comments.